hour passes and I'm feeling down.
Welcome to the Election Nerds. We're a monthly show about all things politics and policy. We're recorded live in the studios of 2SER in Sydney and podcast from our website at www.electionnerds.info. I'm Amanda Elliott from the Department of Sociology at the University of Sydney, and with me for the very last time is my co-host, Dr. Stuart Jackson from the Department of Government and International Relations. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, Amanda. Sorry, I wanted to butt in all the way through your intro. I'll wait.
So we're Stuart and, in fact, our producer, Peter Chen, are moving on to bigger and better things. And this is going to be our last live.
Just moving on.
And this is going to be our last live show. We're going to move to a podcast format. So stay tuned for more information about
this
that.
Is, I believe you are.
We are. It's going to be exciting. Stuart, there's been a lot going on. Talk to me about the Greens. Talk to me about Scott Ludlam. What happened?
It's really, really quite straightforward. It's a very easy narrative. Scott was silly enough, 9 years ago, not to give up his New Zealand citizenship. When he was elected to Parliament, he thought he had given it up when he became an Australian citizen. He came here at three. 9 years down the track, a local lawyer, John Cameron in Perth, I actually know someone who knows him. It's like, oh, no. Decided to do some checking on Darren Hinch and Scott. Unfortunately, Darren Hinch turns out to have renounced his citizenship, and Scott had not. He appears on the citizenship register. So the party was advised over a week ago, 9 days ago, as was the clerk of the Senate. The ensuing week, there was a few media stories around a few things, and then suddenly, bang, that's it.
That's it, he's done.
He's pulled the pin, walked away.
So let's get this straight, though. He comes over here when he's three.
Yep.
And fails to renounce his citizenship because, what, he forgot he had it?
Because he thought when he turned 18 and became an Australian citizen, he did the citizenship ceremony, that he thought that got rid of it.
Yeah, right.
I have to say... It's an odd assumption. I can see how you'd make it. He probably got it in his head that that's what had happened.
Yeah.
I have to say, having been a party returning officer in the past, long distant past, and also a person who used to sign the forms in the long distant past, one of the first things you asked is, where were you born and have you renounced your citizenship? There's a slip-up.
Yeah.
It's a learning lesson that all parties, I suppose, have to go through and get it right.
So what happens now?
The Senate almost certainly will refer this to the High Court. The High Court will sit as the Court of Disputed Returns, and the Court will make a determination that it should be a recount, which is what's happened in the past.
Yeah.
It will be recounted, and Jordan Steele John will be elected. He kind of wants the job but kind of doesn't want the job. He wants the party to make the decision, so he will say, OK, I'm going to resign but have a pre-selection. And then the party can actually choose who the replacement will be. So the Greens can. They can't in the instance of a recount, but if someone resigns, they do. That's Section 77, I think it is, of the Constitution.
Yeah.
The amendment from 1978, the one that Malcolm Fraser introduced and the Labor Party supported, so they wouldn't have another Fields incident. Mm-hmm.
So there you go.
There's even a bit of constitutional history for you as well. So that's the story. Monumental F up. which comes at the end of a couple of maybe 3-4 weeks of really bad press for the Greens. They've not been able to win a thing.
Internally as well.
This is what I'm thinking. That internally, externally, it's just been one long mess. I suppose every party has to have a bad period, but this is their bad period at this point. So apart from assault allegations at various states, apart from the whole Lee Rhiannon saga, apart from Scott Ludlam, I mean, what more can happen? I mean, lightning struck more than once, twice, or even thrice. The party will be thinking, can we make it through the rest of the year? Not that they're the only party that's got these sort of dramas. As someone noted earlier, perhaps they are just a grown-up party now.
And this is what happens when you get grown up.
Well, apparently so. You turn into Donald Trump or something. I don't know.
Which brings us, in fact, nice segue, Stuart, brings us to the focus of today's show, which is the Trump effect.
Yes.
We've had a week of, you know, email releases from Suns and the G20. It's been, I think I got this right, 176 days since he took office. And in that time, there have just been endless kind of scandals surrounding both domestic and international stages and his engagement. Lots of it's played out on Twitter. Love him or hate him, everyone seems to have an opinion about Trump, but we thought it might be a really good time to bring some more scholarly analysis to this discussion in terms of the future of what's not only what's been happening in the US, but what this bodes for the future of politics and how it happens. And having said that, there's also, and I think all of our guests this week are involved in a two-day forum at the University of Sydney that marks the centenary of the establishment of the Department of Government and International Relations.
I think everybody here,
your department,
the whole of the department, all the people that are here, in fact, you know, including Peter and myself, I suspect, will all be involved. We'll all be, you know, doing our piece for the Trump effect.
Yes, the Trump effect. And in that, the forum, it's titled The Politics of Trump, and it explores some of the implications of the Trump campaign and presidency. The forum's actually free and it's open to the public, so we'll try and put some details of how to book on our website. All our listeners can come along. So all our guests, and as Stuart said, my co-host, Stuart, and indeed our producer, Peter, are presenting at the forum. So tonight shows a bit of a taste of what to expect. So our guests are Professor Ariadne Vroman. Hi, Ari.
Hi,
welcome,
Amanda.
Back to the show.
Always happy to be here.
Dr. David Smith, who as well as being part of the Department of Government International Relations, is also located at the US Studies Centre.
Hi,
David. And, of course, Dr. Chris Neff from government as well.
Hello.
Welcome back to all of you. I want to kick off this section by talking with you, Chris, because you've just come back, I think, from about 9 months in the US, and you've been doing a lot of things over there. You might be able to tell us about some of them. But I wondered if you could just talk to, having been there, what the general mood in terms of at least the political class is around Trump.
Well, within the political class, I mean, the question is always, what week are we talking about?
Yeah.
Are we talking about this week? Are we talking about 3 weeks ago? Because that does make a difference. But generally speaking, I will say that among Trump voters, they are sort of digging in their heels and don't want to be talked to by perceived elites about what a huge mistake they made in voting for Trump. That's my initial thought.
Yeah.
And then when you get to the political class in terms of Republicans and what the Republican Party is doing, I think they've flushed themselves down a toilet quite quickly by jumping completely on ship with Trump. Now, what is also happening is that this was the election where more evangelicals voted for the Republican nominee than at any point in history.
Right.
And so now you've got all of these administration jobs that have opened up and that need filling, and the evangelical Christians are flooding the market in D.C. and taking up a lot of presidential appointments as public servants and staffing the different agencies. And that's having a radical shift. And so you've sort of got a little bit of like a headless dictator or authoritarian where, you know, he's tweeting off about different things, but you've got a whole apparatus that is being shifted to the right quite significantly. And I've run up against a little bit of this in a recent issue where I was fighting for transgender military service in the U.S. And we were fighting it and we didn't realize at the time, but all of the intel suggests that we weren't really fighting a House Republican. We were fighting the Vice President,
right,
who has been coordinating legislative strategy for the White House on the Hill.
So is there then, I mean, this is kind of is quite interesting. Is it, what role is he, the Vice President, then playing? He's playing quite a significant role. Is that an expanded role from VPs in the past?
Oh, it's absolutely an expanded role. And I think, I mean, and it's quite saying something because Biden was, you know, one of the most powerful vice presidents of all time. And before him, Dick Cheney was one of the most powerful vice presidents of all time. So it says something to have Pence stepping up in such an assertive way. I mean, there are Indiana consultants on the ground that are working with him to drive legislative strategy. The vice president has established a political action committee. No vice president in American history has established a political action committee in the first year or in the second year or in the third year. So to do this and to take these steps, he's setting up an institutional arrangement where he can either inherit power, seize power, or just wait for everything to fall apart.
So he really is President Pence.
Legislatively, that is certainly the – I would argue that's certainly the case, that – you know, Paul Ryan is talking to him more than he's talking to Trump.
Well, that wouldn't surprise me. Did those two not get on at one point, I seem to remember? Paul Ryan and President Trump when he was not President Trump?
Well, Steve Bannon, the president's senior advisor at Breitbart, has been trying to have Speaker Ryan fired for the better part of 2 years. I think it's clear to say that inside the White House, Paul Ryan is not seen as someone who is loyal to Trump and therefore expendable.
Wow. Which says something else, which says a lot, actually. Well, then again, President, I'm thinking of other speakers. I'm thinking of Newt Gingrich, which was a great speaker, if you remember the great speakers that we've had. Or they've
Tip
had.
O'Neill.
Yeah, wonderful people. I also wanted to ask about what some of the political divisions that are appearing, particularly around the White House, potentially in the White House, but is it opening up divisions within the Republican Party itself?
I mean, I would say yes. I mean, when you see, you know, Bush campaign staff, former Bush White House staff, former H.W. Bush White House staff all coming out strongly against Trump. Pence said the other day, to go back to him, he said the other day when he was asked about the Trump Jr. email scandal, he said that was before my time. So he's distancing himself.
Yeah,
and that's an extraordinary thing to say for a sitting vice president, to say that was before my time on a campaign that nominated him and brought him to the White House. So, you know, I do think that there's a division, and you've got old school establishment Republicans, and you see a little bit of blow up. Like Rex Tillerson has screamed at two White House staff in the last 2 weeks. Mattis has certainly gone off on his making sure that he's independent. And so different agency leaders have initiated and shown that there's a little bit of a split in the party.
How is that playing out, though? I mean, I wonder. We have this whole idea of, you know, the establishment party and how it operates. But Trump, of course, was anti-establishment. I mean, is it playing out on the ground? Are we actually seeing Republicans going, oh, we're not going to give these, you know, silly buggers any money? Or is he going to do the, here I am going to do Howard Dean, right? Is he going to explode and everybody go, actually, he is mad? Or keep funding him little dollar by dollar or $2 by $2 and keep Trump in the game somehow? I wonder if it's actually playing out with the ordinary Trump supporter voter.
The ordinary Trump supporter supports Trump. I mean, there's nothing that's happened so far. And until the day he leaves office, they will probably stand by him. It's a very odd phenomenon. It's nationalistic based. It's almost as if Trump is the American president and everyone else is talking about some other president. So it's rooted in nationalism. I mean, Steve Bannon has done a masterful job of manipulating the public, selling a con artist, and scamming the American public. And, I mean, I think that's it's quite clearly
it's
what's happened.
News, isn't it?
So. Yeah.
He's done particularly well in that sense.
And he certainly mobilized those strategies he'd worked out on Breitbart over a couple of years of how to do that, right?
Well, it's genius.
Yeah.
And the Democratic Party doesn't know what to do yet. I mean, they're still sort of stuck in the mud. They have no message. They haven't had a message in 3 years. And I think that is a huge problem when you're confronting, you know, the most disastrous administration in the last 50 years. I mean, the Democratic Party can't come up with a message other than anti-Trump.
Well, and particularly if you're talking then about really welded on attachment with voters, an anti-Trump message isn't going to get them over the line, is it? Are they relying on some kind of, you know, impeachment that, you know, maybe this is going to transform everything?
The Democratic Party has a long history of trying to wait for the Republican president to implode upon himself, not feeling the need to do anything special or to place an alternative government in front of the American people. And that happened with Richard Nixon. He did self-implode. Yeah. But the fact is that Trump is probably worse than Nixon, and that probably means he won't self-implode. You know, it will go to Robert Mueller. It will involve a full investigation, and that will take probably 3 years.
So we're not seeing a resurgence of the Democrats nationally, I guess is what you're saying.
I don't have any evidence that there's a resurgence nationally. I mean, people standing up in movie theaters and Broadway to cheer Hillary Clinton is not evidence of a resurgent Democratic Party.
Yeah.
And Democrats are sort of deluding themselves that they've got it. And that's what led us to the first to this gigantic catastrophe, is them sort of having confidence that they were going to turn out voters when they weren't. Mm-hmm. They need to retool their message. They are not talking to people in a way that is moving people to vote for them. That's the facts. And being anti-Trump is not enough, and it's proven to be not enough.
This is such interesting kind of, you know, how political parties are clued in or not clued in. But I also want to ask you some questions, Chris, about how policy is playing out. I mean, you've talked about Pence's legislative agenda, and, you know, there's been a lot of reflection in the last 6 months about for a longer period about Trump's lack of experience in government. And I'm just wondering how this is playing out in terms of policy and the legislative agenda.
I'd say there's two main things that everyone should know. The first is that with the huge chasm of unappointed positions, the government is left half-staffed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's being left half-staffed for a longer period of time into an administration, 175 days, than at any previous point. So it's really catching people off guard. Now, you would think that this would benefit the bureaucracy, and the people who are sitting there would usually have an opportunity. But what we've saw in 8 years of George W. Bush and 8 years of Barack Obama is an attempt to centralize power in the White House across all agencies, just centralization. And so what that's meant is that from a policy point of view, Trump has been able to do just about anything he's wanted to do without dealing with the Congress and without dealing with the bureaucracy. And so he doesn't have these positions filled. And usually you would see that causing a problem or leveraging in favor of public servants. But that's not what's happened. And in part, that's President Obama's fault, because he followed George W. Bush. And the centralization, it really eats away at a balance between the different branches of government.
Yeah. I mean, this is so interesting. I mean, I know one of your areas of research is around emotions and public policy. And one of the things I was thinking about just in reflecting on the last few months is this really clear, I mean, evidence-based policy is problematic. We know it conceptually and how it's talked about. But that they're just, you know, is what we're saying a kind of new way of thinking about policy that is either a reversion or is it something new that's a shift away from an evidence framework to one that's much more emotively driven and driven by the individual?
I think it's pretty close to that. I think what you see is a long period of time where trust and confidence in the institutions of government eroded. And then you had the most manipulative presidential candidate in American history take advantage of that in order to gain office.
Mm.
And when you combine those two, the erosion of institutions with a highly manipulative actor, I think it sets up the sort of disaster that we're currently in. And I don't think there's any other way to consider it. I think half the people in the White House would call it a disaster. So, you know, when you look at it, there is certainly this emotive manipulation that's happening to nationalize an election, to create a set of others, to create us, the Americans that you know, from 1950 that you know and believe, and then a refugee policy and an immigration policy and a just decision to not treat the judiciary as equal, mm-hmm. and a decision to not treat the media as equal, and a decision to not treat legislators as equal. And you sort of go down the line, and whether it's, you know, Maxine Waters on the Democratic side, or whether it's the judge Carmona, who they thought was of Mexican, and he's from, I think, Indiana. I mean, the simple fact is that these things are being blown out of proportion. Emotionality is certainly at play. Evidence is not at play at all. But I think the root of it is sort of the nationalist strain of emotion, mm-hmm. as opposed to pulling on the heartstrings. If pulling on the heartstrings were going to work, we wouldn't see the healthcare bill that we're about to see.
Well, I was going to actually ask about the healthcare bill, given that I keep on hearing that people aren't wanting to vote for the Cruz amendments. In fact, the CBO actually said that it's going to cost, it's going to cut so many more people off. It's going to cost money. The insurance industry has now come out and said, no, the Cruz amendments are actually bad for business and they're bad for us. Yet you have the group around Senator Susan Collins and the more moderates saying, well, they're also not going to vote. Can it be bridged? Can McConnell bridge this apparent divide with one bill?
Well, it's interesting. People have been saying, oh, this is dead. The bill's dead. It's not going anywhere. I don't believe any of that. The simple fact is that Mitch McConnell is one of the most successful legislative craftsmen in modern political history. And if anybody can get this across the line, or in other words, if he can sell out enough constituencies to get to marshal 50 people or 49 plus the, or I guess 50 plus the vice president to vote for it, then he will. But he's willing to sell his mother to get the bill across. And so I think if those are the stakes, then I would never count against Mitch McConnell.
Wow. Oh, well, it's still going, yes.
We're going to take a very short break with this community radio announcement before we're back to talk more about the crisis of contemporary politics in the US.
UTS is number one again, ranked as Australia's number one young university for the third year in a row. Our students agree.
UTS is such a young and energetic university. It's encouraged me to consider new paths to be ready for my industry. I think UTS has a creative and entrepreneurial approach to learning that other unis don't have, and this will make such a difference to my future study and career.
Join us for a course info evening. To learn more, go online and search UTS Course Info Night. UTS, sponsors of 2SER 107.3.
Hi, you're back with the Election Nerds. I'm Dr. Stuart Jackson. My co-host is Dr. Amanda Elliott. We're here with three lovely guests, and I wish to talk to one of them, Dr. David Smith from the University of Sydney, Department of Government International Relations and the US Studies Centre. David, we know that Trump was elected with no experience. He has no governmental experience. Oh, actually, I did read somewhere that he'd done something minor, right at the very beginning, something somewhere, but it didn't count.
He ran for school president?
That's something like that, something as strange as that. He's surrounded by family. He's surrounded by a cabinet of the wealthy, the swamp. In fact, when you drained the swamp, it was left only with the mud at the bottom. It's challenged the legitimacy of an electoral system, which has worked for better or for worse for the last couple of hundred years. And he's certainly broken more than one norm of presidential restraint. We only have to think to his G20 meeting, apart from being completely isolated, now it's G19 and the US. We have to just think of his reaction to President Macron's, France's wife, and his grab of her, his continual commentary, his attacks upon the media on Twitter and the like, and we'll come back to that a bit later. His engagement, as we were just discussing, with the judiciary, foreign policy, which appears to be in some kind of weird flux, talked about a crisis of democracy. Are we in a crisis? Is the United States actually in crisis? Is the US political system in crisis? I mean, we love crisis, but is it?
The US political system is always in crisis to some degree. And this comes back to the founding bargain of the United States, which was at the Constitutional Convention, there was one faction that wanted a strong federal government. There was one faction that wanted no federal government at all. The compromise was a federal government that usually doesn't work. So this is not entirely unusual in an historical perspective. It all looks very weird and bad following on from Barack Obama, which in retrospect looks like an administration that adhered to these very, very high normative standards. I mean, there was almost nothing in the way of corruption scandals during Obama. Everything was done by the book. And that is what Obama had to do in order to win the trust of the American people. That was just, he could not do a George W. Bush and sort of swan in there and do whatever he liked. He always had to work harder to get that trust. But I think we have to remember that the United States has only been a full democracy since 1964, or possibly later, which was the signing of the Civil Rights Act. Until that point, large parts of the United States population in large geographic areas of the United States were denied political rights, including the vote. And so it's always tempting to sort of say Trump is the worst ever, Trump is degrading all of these institutions. But we can't actually romanticize the American past and actually how much democracy has been compromised during American history. And to some extent, how attacks on norms are actually, in the historical long run, a normal part of American politics. And even presidents that we consider the good ones did that. You know, President Lincoln suspended habeas corpus and threw in jail newspaper editors who disagreed with him. FDR decided, two terms, that's not for me. I'm going to have three. I'm going to have four. FDR expanded the number of justices on the Supreme Court in order that he could stack it with political allies. In the historical long run, none of this is entirely unusual, even if it looks very bad in the historical moment. Now, there are some things that are unprecedented about Trump. He's the first one, not only with no political experience, but with no military experience. The level of reliance on his family, I find genuinely disturbing. The fact that he will impromptu elevate Ivanka to some high-level diplomatic position. Part of what the Donald Trump Jr. email scandal shows is that Trump entrusts his children with tasks that are ludicrously beyond them. You know, you would not send Donald Trump Jr. to collect a piece of mail from your pigeonhole. You know, he got sent to a meeting with a foreign national who was allegedly offering information on behalf of the Russian government. Trump gleefully smashes norms.
I'm going to leap in there for a second, though.
Yeah.
As you were talking, I was thinking, oh, hang on. Yeah. Yes, you're right. Lyndon Johnson, you know, reputedly stole the 1964 election. There's at least two elements there within Texas and around Chicago. People have said it's fairly clear that election
was... That was Kennedy, not in 1960, not Johnson.
Johnson
in 64 was a genuine landslide. But Kennedy in 1960, yes, it came down to handfuls of votes. In Illinois, some of which were dead people, and Texas that Johnson brought along with him. So Trump, yeah, he gleefully smashes norms, but he's not the first person to do that either. Margaret Thatcher was a gleeful smasher of norms. Rupert Murdoch is a gleeful smasher of norms. It's amazing what you can accomplish when you just don't care. When your view is, I am not constrained by these institutions and I'm certainly not constrained by norms, let's see how far I can go before somebody stops me. And that's been Trump's whole approach. Now, we have to say Trump has actually been stopped at many points. Federal courts stopped his immigration ban. The fact that he knows nothing about the legislative process and has no idea how to advance legislation, and frankly seems too lazy to really get involved in debates around healthcare. If you look at the contrast with Obama, who spent a year working away at the legislative process, there is still an excellent chance that healthcare could fail in the Senate because Mitch McConnell, in the end, might have the view that if this horrible thing they're proposing actually gets through, Republican senators will be in danger. And, you know, they expect to be around for longer than Trump is. So Trump is hamstrung by his own amateurishness to some extent. So the same thing that makes him completely disregard norms and which gives him a level of power in some way to act without constraint, it does also constrain him because it means he doesn't understand how to work within that system. And even people who are political allies of his often pull back from actually supporting him all the way, because in many cases they know they'll be around for longer than he is.
Wow. That's an interesting contrast then, isn't it, with someone like, say, Margaret Thatcher, who did know how to work the system as well as break norms. I mean, that analysis, David, suggests that Thatcher might, you know, in the long kind of view of history, will have had more of an effect, perhaps, than Trump.
I completely believe that. I mean, even from a relatively recent historical perspective, it's clear that Thatcher was an absolutely transformative figure, not just in Britain, but globally. She showed the way for a lot of other people, a particular way. I think it's... Certainly there are a lot of people gathered around Trump who believe that Trump could be the same. They believe that he could recalibrate political ideology around, as Chris was saying, nationalism. That, you know, this is the end of cosmopolitan globalism. There's a new nationalist era in which governments, you know, are supposed to act on behalf of the nation state. And
because that's worked out so well in the past.
Yeah, and, you know, enact trade barriers and not get involved in binding international agreements. Everything should be conducted on a bilateral basis, which is very much how Trump seems to want to do business. But yes,
so where does this lead us with Russia then? I mean, we've launched the foreign policy, so we might as well stay there.
Yeah.
Particularly, I mean, which, as I say, we have just had the G19 plus the US. Peter and I are having a little side conversation here. I wanted to think about Russia for a moment because I think Russia is, you know, clearly been the thing. You know, we have Robert Mueller doing his investigations. There's all the stuff around Donald Jr. and the like, all the stuff around Russia. You've mentioned bilateralism coming in forward for Trump. He wants to have these I'll have a meeting with Trump. I mean, which in one respect reminded me of Gorbachev and Reagan, in another completely different because I think they're two completely different characters. And certainly their desires for world peace are completely different. Will the whole Russia stuff lead anywhere? I mean, what is Trump's relationship with Putin and Russia, and will it remain the same? And will it lead to any changes about Russia in terms of domestic politics?
That's a good question. I think that Trump's fundamental attraction to Russia is to do with his whole worldview of international relations, which is that rather than being part of multilateral cooperative institutions, which Trump believes rip off the United States, he really just believes that the United States should deal with the other top powers. The US should just deal with Russia, deal with China, deal with Saudi Arabia in the Middle East. Essentially, that the US should deal with the top regional power in every region and get them to solve all the region's problems in a way that doesn't impose a burden on the United States. So his view of North Korea, for example, is that really it's China's responsibility to sort it out, and it will just be a function of US-China relations, how that's resolved. Certainly he believes that Russia can solve Syria, and that's, I think, been a major part of his strategic thinking there. And he's always been very big on this idea of the US should have better relations with Russia. I think part of that for him is just personal admiration of Vladimir Putin as well. He personally admires these strong leaders, regardless of what kind of political system it is that they're heading up. And he would love to have the kind of popularity that Vladimir Putin has in Russia. He would love to be seen as the kind of iconic, transformative figure that Putin is in Russia. So I think there's genuine admiration there. It's very difficult to know what to make of all of the other stuff around emails and things like that. You know, how much of a relationship did Trump really have with Russia before the election, and how much does this shape his approach to Russia now? I think that a lot of this stuff has been a bit overblown. I don't buy the idea of Trump being Putin's puppet who went to Putin for help to win the election and is now beholden to him. Certainly Trump had a very messy web of business arrangements with Russia prior to the election. Russian money being one of the things that is keeping his empire afloat. He has real estate interests in Russia. Russians have real estate interests in New York. I think that in the end, even if it does turn out that members of his campaign, including possibly his own son, were kind of interested in the possibilities of Russian collusion, I don't see this as a decisive factor in the election. I mean, you could argue that with an election that was that close, you know, potentially 80,000 votes, if they were different, the election would have gone the other way. Maybe every factor is decisive. But I think that the DNC email hack and all the stuff about John Podesta was actually fairly trivial compared to a lot of stuff that came later that seems quite separate from Russia. Nonetheless, it is a very serious matter to have people going to foreign nationals for the kind of help that certain members of the Trump campaign seem to be seeking. And there could be serious legal consequences for the people involved, although we're not talking about treason, we're talking about essentially violations of campaign law. I don't think that any of this stuff will touch Trump himself. Even Don Jr., one of his first acts after he was found out, was to go on Fox News with the explicit purpose of saying, my dad had nothing to do with this.
My question, though, is also about, has it changed perceptions of Russia within the United States, the way that people are reacting to Russia, where once it might have been, you know, the evil bear of the East, and indeed you can still see it from some of the senators, you know, who are going, no, they're our enemy. Certainly McCain and I think Graham are both not great fans of Russia. But has it changed how perhaps ordinary voters, particularly Trump voters, are they now saying Russia is good?
Yeah, they're certainly a lot more favourable to Russia, and in particular to Putin, than they used to be. And, I mean, there is this interesting split within the Republican Party. Foreign policy elites hate Russia. They see it as the major threat to the United States. This was the cornerstone of Mitt Romney's foreign policy, which Obama mercilessly mocked him for. But for ordinary Republican voters, they don't see this as the old Soviet Union. It's not communist. It's, you know, that in their view, if Donald Trump trusts Vladimir Putin, they trust Vladimir Putin. And all the people that they don't trust in the media and the Democrats and all of these institutions in American life, that's who the real enemy is. They don't see Putin as the enemy. So, and it, just opinion polls reflect far more favourable opinions towards Putin among Republicans.
It's a really, I mean, we might come back to this in our post-show chat, because I think there's a really interesting contradiction there, isn't there, around the nationalism of the campaign and the kind of drawing in of a more favourable orientation.
Yes.
Amongst Trump supporters to Russia than perhaps in the past.
A bit of a dream of building a cross-national nationalist coalition, which is pretty unstable historically.
We might come back to some of that, some of those questions in the post-show podcast chat that we do after the live show's finished. We are going to take a short break and come back and talk to Ariadne Vroman about politics and Twitter and the transformation.
UTS is number one again, ranked as Australia's number one young university for the third year in a row. As a truly modern university, we never look back. By continually challenging conventions, we not only change the status quo, we improve it. Join us for a course info evening. To learn more, go online and search UTS Course Info Night. UTS, sponsors of 2SER 107.3.
Love Police bring Americana Gold to Sydney this July with Joe Pug, direct from Austin, Texas, and new discovery, Courtney Marie Andrews.
And I've come to meet the sheriff.
Joe Pug delivers soul-searching classic songs, and Courtney Marie Andrews' new album, Honest Life, has critics raving. Come experience these two incredible artists at the Lansdowne July 11 and Coogee Diggers July 12. Love Police sponsors 2SER 107.3.
Welcome back to Election Nerds. We're talking about the Trump effect with our guests, Dr. Chris Neff, Dr. David Smith and Professor Ariadne Vroman. Ariadne, I want to bring you into the conversation. I've been sitting here very patiently. One of the things about Trump, I suppose, is that he's really, if nothing else, able to communicate with those he sees as his public, and was certainly able to mobilise social media in a way that I suspect we haven't seen before, but I guess it's one of my questions, and certainly in a way that's a bit sinister. I was having a look over the past couple of weeks, and I've seen now advertising and marketing sites which are talking about the lessons from the Trump campaign for brands, you know, like this really kind of interesting switch. And certainly Trump himself credits social media as being a big part of his success, helping him get to the White House. What was it about his social media campaign that was so successful?
Okay, so maybe we need to think about social media in a variety of ways. We need to think about it as having the potential to create this horizontal, networked community of actors, so people feel like that they're part of something, part of a campaign. That wasn't new. That's been going on for at least 10 years. The two Obama campaigns really capitalised on that idea of that individuals could feel like they were part of something, they could share messaging, they could make micro donations to campaigns, and so on. The other way that we can think of social media is the way that leaders use the platforms to totally bypass the traditional or legacy media and to get the messages directly out to who they think of as their audience. And in some ways, this is what we're seeing that Trump has become very able at, but also very willing to participate in that kind of way. And we also need to think about the different platforms that he's using. Even if we contrast the two major platforms, Facebook and Twitter, they are actually they have different audiences. We could probably think about Facebook as being a much more domestically oriented audience. Facebook has, you know, over 80% of sort of people in the US have a Facebook account. People will kind of be sharing everyday videos, messaging, and so on. But then when we look at Twitter, Twitter is still, it's still a minority in a minority use. It's probably only around 20% of Americans using Twitter. It's skewed to the politically engaged. It's skewed to the media itself. So we might even want to think about the Twitter audience for Trump as being those of us around the rest of the world, an international audience, the kind of media audience. And I'm increasingly wondering if he just is using Twitter to kind of, as clickbait, to enrage his opposition. So what we're seeing is that social media is projecting this idea of his leadership, he's telling stories, he's creating this idea of who is the us and who is the them, but very much it's who is the them. Who are our opponents? Who are the people who are stopping us you know, from getting ahead? And I think that's really the way he's using Twitter. So sometimes I kind of think people should stop overreacting to a lot of his tweets, because it's making it more and more a successful space. But then I kind of looked into the way he's using Facebook, and it's really interesting that on his Facebook account, both the Donald Trump Facebook page but also the POTUS page, it's actually just rehashing a lot of his tweet messages. Mm-hmm. So clearly he thinks, well, this is working, or that his staff are thinking this is working. Let's keep generating these messages, which are very much inaccessible language, the overuse of words like good and great, this kind of everyday language that's trying to tap into this idea of the everyday Americans who want to make America great again, that colloquial language, I think is really important. The short videos of him that look very much first-person shot videos, like he's shooting them, of his experience of interacting with international leaders. So it's very much about sort of bringing people into his everydayness as well.
I wonder, I mean, you kind of talked about the Obama campaign, and one of the things, it just kind of occurs to me that one of the things about Trump is it is this direct interaction.
Yes.
With himself, rather than necessarily a set of ideas.
Yeah.
So Obama's campaign was certainly about Obama, but very much about the ideas he was promoting, whereas Trump is...
Oh, of course.
It's Trump.
Obama, it was all, you know, sort of this discursive construction of hope and a better world, and Obama was kind of the vehicle with the experience to do that. It's a really different kind of story. I think it's, I think it probably is one thing that's unprecedented that we're seeing an international leader that is writing all of their own tweets in every day, multiple times a day. Like even, and he has 34 million followers on Twitter around the world. Obama has 90 million followers on Twitter, but he only tweets about three times a month. It's not a major vehicle for him sort of promoting even his sort of post-presidential work, whereas Trump, it's constant. It's immediate. It is that kind of interactive construction of who he is and what he and what he wants to do and who that enemy is that he's going to vanquish.
I mean, how I suppose I'm going to keep contrasting it with the Obama campaign. One of the, I wonder how part of the social media strategy that, that Trump's campaign has used is that just because it's a lot of it's been about bypassing the legacy media, that it is a digital first strategy rather than a broadcasting strategy. And that's, is that new? I mean, is that something that is?
I think we're seeing innovative? A lot of leaders are increasingly fighting that battle. If they can make broadcast directly to their potential voters and bypass the critical engagement and questioning of the media, that's good for anyone. And a lot of them have been doing it. But we tend to see that it really changes from campaign mode to leader mode in that it's very much a sort of oppositional strategy. Even people who were known as, you know, sort of digital pioneers, someone like Malcolm Turnbull was always seen as very digitally active and engaged. As Prime Minister, he barely uses any social media at all. The only other leader that I could think of that uses social media sort of constantly in is Narendra Modi in India, not using it in the same kind of way as Trump, but very active. And still in India, it's very much, you know, only a third of the population have the internet and have access. So it is kind of this international creation of himself as a leader as well. But I guess the other way we could think about how social media is increasingly being used and what was different about more recent campaigns, including the Trump campaign, is the increased use of targeted advertising on Facebook. And this is where what people are talking about as dark ads. So if traditionally advertising has been on television, we've seen negative advertising and so on, we've seen the evolution of dark ads on Facebook, which are very much targeted at particular segments of the population. And we can't, and they're often not even you know, it doesn't say sponsored by such and such party. People will see them in their newsfeed. They might think that they've actually been reshared by friends. And a lot of what the talk is that it was very much negative advertising the Trump campaign was using to depress the votes, to depress the vote amongst particular segments of the population who might have voted for Clinton as well. But it's the unaccountability of these new mechanisms. Mm. They were being used again in the UK election as well, and there's talk that the Theresa May campaign spent more on Facebook targeted advertising at particular segments of the population than they were spending on traditional television advertising at all.
Because that was certainly Trump spent more on social media.
Yeah, Facebook. And particularly on Facebook. Yeah.
Because I was reading some stuff where they were talking about their capacity to road test the ads was so significant on Facebook because it's so based on likes and those kinds of things that they could just target and change ads really quickly to meet what was working and what wasn't.
And part of it is the data matching that they can actually do. When you've got a population that is registered to vote with particular parties, and there's just so much data out there where they can match records of the average citizen, also targeting their likes and the brands and political ideas and so on that they're already engaging with on Facebook. While I think this is sinister, I'm less convinced that the targeted advertising necessarily leads to particular changing views or changing action. That's what we don't have a lot of evidence of. Yeah. There's been a lot of talk about Cambridge Analytica and what it did for the Trump campaign, but we don't really know if those ads worked or if they did move or demobilise or so on. It's, you know, it's in the brand's interest to be able to make the claims that it did because they were able to do this sort of this particular kind of data matching.
I mean, I'd be very interested to see if anybody gets down to actually do that research and, you know, does that collection of data. Because we also know that Trump spent, when he did spend on broadcast media, it was often on radio. So I think it was Michigan had a load of, and Wisconsin as well, but had a load of advertising, but on radio, not on television. So in a different, very different way, but again, kind of targeted to the kinds of radio stations that the kinds of voters are going to listen to. But I suspect much more as background, the sort of stuff not unlike as you would see in your Facebook feed, things going past, and so you're hearing it again. Maybe it's on the bus station, or maybe it's on at the diner, or maybe it's, you know, what you're listening to on when you're driving to work or whatever. Some particular kinds of advertising, which is a different strategy. Well, or in your Uber, yes, or in your pickup, you know, because you're a good old American. But you know, sorry, Chris, there, good old boy there. You're using it as a different way, a different strategy, as opposed to, we'll pour all the money onto television and we'll get people to vote for us because we'll just be blanketing everything.
But we're also seeing the death of broadcast television as well, as people stream when they want, what they want. So advertising is finding it hard to find the television market. So radio, I guess, is the only live medium left in that kind of way.
As we are on radio.
Indeed. I mean, I wonder, Ariadne, you know, you've been working in this field for a really long time and kind of paying attention to social media and its relationship, you know, the kind of political promise of the internet. I mean, I can remember, you know, you and I having conversations years ago about some of those early debates.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, are we, you know, is this the realisation of that political promise? It's not looking particularly like, it's not rosy, is it? It's not rosy.
I think it's getting us to think about, you know, they used to refer to people as sort of cyber utopians, people who always thought that the internet had a democratizing potential. I don't think that that's necessarily true. It does, and in some instances it does, but it can also be used in negative ways. Progressives are also using targeted advertising in campaigning to get their message across to audiences who wouldn't necessarily see it in their normal feeds or in their normal gathering of news. So I think we need to kind of think about, it is the kind of tactics that are being used now, they will increasingly be used. It can be used for good and for bad. It can be used to inform people in a way, in an era where people are resisting political information more than ever before.
I mean, one of the things I wanted to do, just to move the discussion a little bit, is talk a bit about protesting. I mean, we've heard quite a bit. I mean, we've heard that there isn't a resurgence amongst the Democrats, but we have seen the coming together of significant numbers of people with the marches in Washington, the Women's March, the idea of the Science March, to, you know, refocus our attention on evidence. I mean, are these events, you know, they were fairly big national events. But are there also things happening more locally? And, you know, what kind of role is protest playing? Is there, if we're not seeing a resurgence in the Democrats, are we seeing a resurgence in collective engagement and resistance?
Yeah, I guess I'd really love to know what Chris thinks, because he was there on the ground. I mean, I guess I'm a little bit from afar. I was quite optimistic at this, what we're seeing, a renaissance in particular movements that are digitally enabled and a rapid response, sort of from Black Lives Matter onwards, and we saw this in the Women's March and the Science March that you mentioned. But even David mentioned before, I think one of the most significant events or movements this year has been against the immigration ban. That was a very rapid response, that there were people protesting at airports and blockading airports. There were lawyers coming out to help people from the seven predominantly Muslim countries that were being banned from entering the US, and then it went up through the court system and was overturned. Of course, in the last few weeks, the immigration ban 2.0 has come back, but in a very diluted form. So we could see that movement and that sort of citizen action was an example of something that was a successful form of resistance to something that was a core plank of what Trump wanted to do.
I mean, it does speak to, you know, that in, you can see the possibility, can't you, of something emerging against the nationalist platform.
Yes, you can. But I think as Chris was saying, ultimately it's not enough to be against something or against someone. At the last election, I mean, the Democrats in the end probably didn't have enough apart from being anti-Trump. I mean, and also anti-racist. There was a very strong anti-racist message, but that did not turn out African-Americans and Latinos in the way that it needed to be. There wasn't enough of an affirmative offering, you know, of what the government can do for you. And so as much as we've seen this resistance, self-styled resistance movement, it's not going to be enough unless it is actually arrayed behind a concrete political program that is bigger than just being anti-Trump.
Yeah, and deals with the very real and genuine material and economic concerns that people who are losing their jobs and their livelihoods have.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, no, I think we might follow up some of those, that discussion, because I'm kind of interested in whether or not there is anything emerging, perhaps not from within the political parties, but from within movements themselves.
Well, I must admit, I being the election nerd, I also wanted to talk a little bit about the half dozen, I want to call them by-elections, because that's what they are, you know, that have been had. And the Democrats have taken one in California, which was between two Democrats, and the ones from, we are going to talk about it later, but, you know, about the other ones, which people were saying, oh, they might win, you know, Georgia 6, or they might win these other races, and then fell considerably short in many respects. Yes, there was a big move towards the Democrats in these elections, but these additional or supplementary elections, but it didn't actually happen. And whether that's a warning sign, perhaps, for the midterms, still 18 months away, nonetheless. But we might have to come back to that, because that's the bit that I want to talk about.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I did want to just take a few minutes to note that Election Nerds, this is the Election Nerds' last airing, live airing on 2SER. We've been on air since 2013.
That we know about, anyway.
That we know about, yeah. we might pop in occasionally, but it'll be our last regular on-air live show. And we've been doing it since 2013. Stuart, it's a long time now.
It's 4 years.
We've been, you know, seen two federal elections, a whole bunch of state elections, three prime ministers, four budgets. The list goes on. Yeah, is that all? Election Nerds will be continuing, but we'll no longer be doing a live show on 2SER. Rather, we'll be concentrating on podcasting, on producing podcasts of the show. So we're also having a bit of a changing of the guard with Dr. Stuart Jackson and Dr. Peter Chan, our producer, hanging up their Election Nerd hats and moving on.
Yes, we
Stuart,
are.
Stuart,
aren't we,
you're
Peter?
Leaving. You're leaving me.
Peter's nodding, isn't Peter? Peter is nodding. Yeah, waving goodbye.
I wanted just to give you a moment, Stuart, to have a little reflection on the show, your favourite shows. I think you said before this show your favourite shows have been the election ones.
Logically, yes.
Logically.
Of course.
Where we talk.
You know, I even before we came in, I went away and I said, oh, well, there has been an election happening, apart from Mongolia, won by a former wrestler, which very interesting was a very interesting election. It's a runoff election. The distance between number 2 and 3 was about 1,800 votes. This is in the, you know, whole of Mongolia, and it's like there was even election challenges and whatever. But it went through, and, you know, yes, the former wrestler won. PNG has been having its two-week extravaganza of elections over the last fortnight. They're still counting. I was looking at one of the electorates. We think we have sometimes a long ballot paper. They have individual electorates, single member electorates, and one of them has 63 candidates. Another one had 57 candidates. There's a whole raft of them where they have 50-plus candidates. So it's like, if you think you've got problems with a ballot paper, and it is a form of preferential voting, 1, 2, 3, on the ballot paper. So they're interesting elections up there. The elections, yeah, the last election was quite good. I actually quite liked the very first set of elections we did, simply because they were focused and we were right into it and we were like gung-ho.
They were the days of the weekly shows.
They were indeed. And I also quite liked the one we did this year, actually, the stuff around, not Brexit, but around the UK election, because it's actually kind of exciting. You know, there was things happening and, oh, you know, it was unusual. And for that matter, the last federal election on the night and you're going, oh, my God, what the hell's going on?
Yes.
You know? And that's I have to say, you know, the fun parts for me.
No, and I think I have persuaded Stuart that he's going to pop in for some of our election-specific podcasts. I do just want to take a moment to say a big thank you to 2SER, who's hosted us for the last 4 years. No doubt Peter Stewart and I will continue to have some kind of relationship with 2SER. We often pop up on The Wire or other shows having our piece to say. And I want to say a special thank you to Anthony Dockrell, who's been a big supporter of the show, including panelling for us in the early days.
We need to wrap up now. We've got the last minute, so goodbye. No, you have been listening to The Election Nurse, July 2017 Trump Effect Show, broadcast for the final time from the studios of 2SER Radio in Sydney. The Election Nerds will continue to bring informed policy and political analysis to you as a podcast and is available on iTunes and the show page, www.electionnerds.info. And I'll stop talking so fast. We can contact us from this page, tweet to @electionnerds, tweet, or find us on Facebook and Instagram. Please take a moment to rate the show on iTunes. And as I say, tell your friends to tune in. Tell your friends to listen to the podcast in the future.